This broadcast of OPF Radio on April 15th of 2013 asks the question, taxes, what are they for? Gary Hunt is the guest, and your host is Sleepy Salsa. And that was Ashley Alisize's A Dangerous Situation. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Outposts of Freedom Radio. Governments do not create value. Anything they have was first taken from somebody else. The framers understood the inherently dangerous nature of the state, which is why they sought to shackle it with the chains of the Constitution. Understanding the confiscatory powers of government is integral towards coming to terms with its justifications for why it initiates force against the citizenry. Perhaps there also might still exist ways for us to preserve what remaining wealth we have left. With that said, let us turn to our guests. Gary, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Sleepy.
Good evening. Well, let's jump right into it. Gary, what are taxes?
Taxes are the dues we pay for to live in a society, just like joining an organization that does have functions or something like that, you pay your way. Now, historically, though, taxes have been very diverse, and in many cases, especially in monarchies and dictatorships, the money all goes to a certain class of people. The intention in this country, however, was to have reasonable taxes, and so those taxes should be reasonable because we don't have the royal court that they did in European nations. But any society will have some form of taxation to provide the services that are necessary to maintain the society together.
Does the Constitution authorize taxes?
Yes, it does, very explicitly. And this is one of the relinquishments that we gave when we became members by birth or by becoming citizens of this country. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 of the Constitution, which is the legislative, Article 1 is legislative, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So, yes, we did relinquish, back to the Articles of Confederation, requisitions were put on the states, and the states either paid the requisitions or did not, which meant that the Congress, in trying to fight a war against the British, sometimes was trying to do so without any money at all because requisitions weren't met. There was also provision for direct taxes, but they would be uniform the states, or proportioned to the states. But yes, the duties were explicitly given in the Constitution, and if you look in any state constitution, you will also see that there's a provision for taxes.
Could you provide us with a brief history of taxation in these United States?
Well, we'll see. I think we need to go back to the United Colonies to understand this. The United Colonies were subject to, all of the colonies assessed taxes. A lot of them were excise taxes. In most colonies, taverns had to pay an excise tax. And the government needed money to operate on it just like anywhere else. Now, the rub came when the British Parliament and the King decided that they were going to pay the debt from the French and Indian Wars by raising revenue in the United States or in the colony, the colonies, and they did so by imposing taxes. Now, interestingly, I have yet to find any situation where anybody paid more than 5%. The highest one I've actually found is 3.5% tax, but this money was assessed by Parliament against the people on tea, paper, sugar, rum, various items, and they objected to those, and that would be like sales tax today, which generally runs 7 to 9% in most states. But that was assessed to offset the debt, but it was assessed by Parliament rather than Parliament telling each of the colonies, we need you to pay so much money, so you raise the taxes any way you want to. Taxation without representation became the call sign. So taxes, the Articles of Confederation had problems because they could not assess taxes to the colonies, and the colonies were fairly well off, but they didn't want to part with their money. So when the Constitution was written, it had a provision where this requisition system would not apply, that the government could tax certain things, the enumerated things, directly. That changed the nature, similar to what happened in the Parliament. However, since every state in the Union was a member of the Senate and the House of Representatives, or represented in the state Senate and the House of Representatives, at least the taxation would be approved by the elected officials that went to Washington. Now, they were first relatively low. The first direct taxes, for example, War of 1812, the quasi-war with France a few years before that, when the possibility existed that we would go to war with France, and the Civil War were the first instances of direct taxes being applied. However, those taxes were applied to property, not to income. And it was finally argued, this changed in 1913 with the 16th Amendment, argued that taxation of land was the wrong way to do it, because it was supposed to be apportioned among the states. So a large state felt that it paying a greater share was a burden. Virginia was agricultural, for example, so the tax on land in Virginia would be comparable, say, on a per acre basis as it would be in Massachusetts, but Massachusetts made a lot more off of an acre of land than the people in Virginia. So it was determined to be in balance, which is where the income tax came in. But, you know, there are some serious questions about the validity of the income tax and the direct tax as well, but we'll get into those. But that's a brief history. Now, when the income tax started, it was relatively low, and it's been, at some points in its history, it has been extremely high. Right now, generally, it's about 30%, but it was up to 80 or 85% on wealthy people during some of that course of its history.
Now, you mentioned something very interesting a few moments ago about the cost of living in society. Let's revisit that for just a moment. Is it accurate to say that taxes are the cost of living in a society?
Absolutely. I mean, how can a government exist? Now, we have to look at what the government does, though. And fortunately, our society of self-government had limitations in the Constitution. And if those limitations were adhered to, it wouldn't be that expensive to live in the United States of America. The taxes would be relatively small. Right now, the taxes won't even pay the debt service on it because the government's gotten out of hand. But, yes, it is the balance, because the government will always provide some service, whether it's just protection from foreign invasion, roads, other administrative functions, security of commerce on the high seas or in the air. All these are elements that are necessary, and they've got to be paid for somehow. And so they are definitely one of the burdens of living in a society, an organized society that provides whatever services it provides.
Do government salaries come out of taxes?
Yes, And there was discussion during the Constitutional Convention of whether the legislature should be unpaid or paid. Ben Franklin felt that it and others felt that it should be people, gentlemen, who had self-sustaining wealth and would pay their own way. And then the other side was that, no, we want more lay people. We want farmers and businessmen in Congress, and we've got to offset their expenses of doing so. And so the provision in the Constitution is that they shall be the elected officials in the congressional branch or legislative branch will receive a salary for services. Now that's kind of limiting, a salary for services. That says a salary for services. It doesn't say this, that, and you know, 100 other things, which is one of the excesses that we've run into. In fact, looking back historically, John Adams, the first president to occupy the White House, had to pay his way to Washington, from Boston to Washington. And then most of the furnishing of the White House was done at his, a lot of the furnishing, I should say, was done at his expense. Abraham Lincoln's wife was trying to live on the relatively small budget they had because the meals had to be bought out of the president's salary, unless it was a state dinner. So when they had a family dinner, breakfast, lunch, and a family dinner, they had to pay for the food themselves. Now, the staff was provided as part of the White House. They didn't have to pay for the staff, but the groceries had to be bought. Now we've got $2 million pizzas from time to time. But only the salary should come out. Salaries and materials necessary to perform the deed. This includes the judges have to be paid, obviously, and the president and the executive branch have to be paid. The members of the military have to be paid. So those salaries or wages or whatever we might refer to them as definitely have to come out of that, and that is the cost of government. However, again, in this country, it has become extremely excessive, beyond the imagination. I don't think the worst of the Federals could have ever conceived that the government would actually now spend more than the wealthiest king in monarchical societies.
What can you tell us about the history of local taxes?
Well, local tax is the same thing. That in fact, there's a very good book. I've scanned it and put it online. It was published in 1891. It's called Elements of Civil Government. And it talks about and approaches the whole concept of government in a rather interesting manner. And let me run through briefly how they look at government. The closest government to you is the family, and each person in the family pays his taxes by his efforts, not in cash, but by doing chores, cooking, gardening, whatever tasks are put on the child, and the wife, and the husband, who has to bring home the bacon, so to speak. There's also the church. Is the next level up in government, and there's an obedience to the church, and there was tithing then, not necessarily now, but the structure is interesting. Then comes the town, and obviously the town roads have to be maintained, certain things have to be done, relatively small expenses, so when they're distributed between all the people in town, they're almost insignificant. And then comes the school district, which had to hire the teacher, build the school, things like that. We didn't have the structure we have now, but the school district was a form of government, and if you were in the school district, you had to support the school district as a form of government. And then the county, which would do the larger road networks between towns, and sometimes flood control projects, things that were necessary for the stability, especially in agricultural areas within that county. And then we go to the state level, which, again, has a larger network of roads that it's got to maintain, and it's got other functions from the militia all the way up to the legislative branch that, like the federal government, has to have money to perform its duties, and to pay the people that work within it. And then we jump up to the federal level and its responsibilities, delegated responsibilities as per the Constitution. But the history, again, going back, taxes were relatively small. They were almost insignificant. They weren't detrimental to people the way they are now. But if we look at taxes now, let's say you've got an 8% sales tax, and then you've got 30% on your income, and then you pay taxes on batteries, tires, and gasoline for your car. You pay permit fees, and I was in land surveyor, was involved in development, so I've seen that situations where to build a house, you pay upwards of $30,000 just for the permits to build a house. Now, my first house only cost me $22,500, and it was a three-bedroom house with a fairly large lot. But now the taxes for that same house, and this is out in Florida, I mean the permit fees, which are basically a tax, exceed the cost of my first house, the first house that I bought. Again, we're talking about excesses, but so the history of taxes has a solid foundation, and it was a well-recognized and understood responsibility in most cases to pay your share of these participatory governments that you were involved in, from the family all the way up to the United States government.
Are tariffs a type of tax?
Oh, let me thumb through here and find tariff real quick. Yes, they are. They're a form of tax for a specific purpose, and I thought I had the page marked, but the marker just fell on the floor.
Well, I could have sworn that tariffs were part of the Constitution. I could have sworn it was in there somewhere.
They are. They were in the ones that I listed. Back to the list, Article 1, Section 8. Duties and imposts. And tariffs are a type of I think it kind of encompasses the two of them. This whole tax issue is something I've tried to avoid for many years. But a tariff is a list or schedule of articles on which a duty is imposed upon their importation into the United States with the rates at which they are severally taxed. Also, the custom or duty payable on such articles, and derivatively, the system or principle of imposing duties on the importation of foreign merchandise. So, tariff is basically the method of assessment of duties. Now, the Morrell tariff was one that led to the Civil War because it was excessive and burdensome on the South and basically gave a free ride to the North. But, yes, tariffs they are definitely one of the enumerated taxes, and, like I say, it's just the scheduling of how it's assessed.
Well, with that question answered, then we probably should then look at the following then. What is the purpose of the administrative agency known as the Internal Revenue Service?
Well, my understanding, and this goes back quite a ways, the Internal Revenue Service was initially instituted, or what became, it may be what became the Internal Revenue Service. Most of the officers of the Internal Revenue Service were actually in foreign ports to verify what goods were being shipped to the United States and make sure that, the bill of lading was there, and also to make sure that they collected from on behalf of the American banks that were loaning money to these foreign ports and helping. Remember back then, the only only Canada and the United States were fairly civilized. The rest of the South American countries were pretty much in turmoil and run by dictators. So the two purposes were to identify goods going to the United States and do the bill of lading, and to make sure that, or to collect the revenues that were due by foreign interests on those bills of lading. It wasn't until the Civil War that they the direct tax in the Civil War, where they actually were implemented along the lines of what they currently are, to collect the direct taxes to best of my knowledge, though, they didn't go south of the Mason-Dixon line to collect those taxes. They just stayed north of it because it was a little safer. And the tax then was relatively small, and I don't recall, but I think it was less than 10% at highest during the Civil War, and many people were not taxed. Money was scarce back then, and so people couldn't pay. And if the tax was in specie, some people never saw specie in their entire life, or most of their life at least. But the Internal Revenue Service has grown to the most feared monster in this country, that more people are afraid of Internal Revenue Service than anything else in the world. So that that's kind of a poor representation of a self-governed society where you fear the government that you're supposed to have control over.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, on that note, you know, my best friend was actually filling out the income tax stuff and whatnot. And something that really pained me the entire time, and I know this is common with a lot of folks when they're filling it out, is that stress and tension of even just filling it out. So just a kind of a spur of the moment question then, would it be accurate to say then, Gary, that the stress and tension that an individual experiences when they are filling out, whether it be a W-4 or a 1040 or whatever form it is, isn't that a kind of form of tyranny in and of itself?
It is. It's currently applied, and it's rather deceiving. I don't have a 1040. I haven't seen one in quite a while, but they say something like voluntary compliance. And we all know what an oxymoron is. How can it be a voluntary compliance? If it's compliance, it's mandatory. Therefore, it's not voluntary. And so, you know, what does this amount to? Does this mean you either volunteer or I'm going to shoot you? But just as far as stress, and then look at our society, too. We're becoming a service-oriented nation, and the tax business, tax industry, the H&R Block and all these people, this is hundreds of billions of dollars a year. That and attorneys. Attorneys are paid big bucks to find ways to reduce taxes. And so some people walk away with money in the pocket that they didn't put in taxes. It's a point of stress. It's cost people their lives. In the last 30 years, I'm familiar with a number of people who have died with, I didn't know them, I don't mistake what I said, but a number of people who have died as a consequence of an internal revenue taxes, whether it was trying to keep the sheriff off of their property when it was going to be seized by the Internal Revenue Service. And I went through this back in 1981 when the IRS came, and they took everything out of my office and shipped it to a warehouse and then put it up for auction. Now, I bought it back from them later on, but it's pretty stressful when they can just come in and take your goods without a warrant. But I got to thank the IRS from time to time, because if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have begun learning about taxes and government and all this. I would have just gone on with life. But they came down on me so hard, and I can fully appreciate the stress as a consequence. My business was shut down for weeks until I got the equipment back so that I could do my work. Now, they wanted me to work and pay them back before I got my equipment back. How do you do that?
You know, so much for due process.
Take your guitar, how do you make money making music so you can pay the taxes? There's no thought, there's no common sense in the administration of that whole system. And the reason is so burdensome, though, is the high amount of taxes. And this, again, this all falls back on the excess of government. We've got a government that is outgrown itself. It has become completely worthless. One hand doesn't know what the other is doing. And everybody's getting paid big bucks. The average employee in the federal government now makes over $106,000 a year. The number of people making over $200,000 a year is astronomical when it was relatively small just 10 years ago.
Yeah, and so much for due process.
There is no due process. Well, there's supposed to be, but there's not. And, yes, it sets aside the Constitution, but that's a whole different subject, and we'll not go into that tonight.
So what are the sources of taxation?
Well, the sources of taxation can be permits, licenses, and these shouldn't be, and we'll get into that, I think, a little later on, but permits, licenses, direct taxes, sales taxes, use taxes, and then taxes you paid to buy something that was had to be higher because the guy that made something had to pay taxes on it too. On the local level, they're still relatively small. However, local communities are getting greedier and greedier. And in California here, I think we've got three cities that have declared bankruptcy. The states are facing the same problem, but there are always holdouts. There's one county in California that is debt-free. They have cut back services without scaring the hell out of the people, saying we'll have to cut back the necessary services. So it's a matter of administration, but then you've got the local, the city and county, you've got the state and the federal government all sources of taking taxes, and they're coming through any number of things. The recent Obamacare, the recent one, it was going to be a penalty, but Justice Roberts decided that it was a tax. So I think it's fair to say that we have a lot of things that are called by different names, but again, they're always taxes in whatever form. They are to support the government in its function, every one of them.
Is paying taxes proof of paying your fair share?
You know, that's a question that people have asked me a lot. How come you're not paying your fair share? I don't believe that income tax is a lawful tax. It might be legal under certain circumstances, but because you make it such, but I don't think it's lawful. So do I have a fair share if it's a voluntary contribution to the government, which is what I believe it is? Fair share is a slogan the government uses to turn neighbor against neighbor. It's equalizing. It's leveling. It's socialism, isn't it? When people, in a derogatory manner, say you aren't paying your fair share, therefore I have to pay more. No, you don't have to pay more. Government's going to get as much as they can get away with, and then they'll supplement that by printing more money to make up the deficiency. And it's not going to cost somebody else more if I don't pay taxes. I'm just smarter than them, and I realize, read the Constitution, and realize there's a limitation on what the federal government can do. And we'll get into some detail on that a little later on. But it's a scam, but it sounds warm and fuzzy to people who pay their taxes. I'm going to give you a good example. There's a book called The Law That Never Was by Red Beckman and, I can't remember the other fellow right now. Rather interesting book, and it has to do with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, which was not ratified according to the book, and I think that's absolutely true, but the courts won't hear it because it's a political matter, whatever that means. My landlady, where my office was in Florida, gave me that book and said, read this. This is a great book. And then she told Wayne on the way out, she stopped and talked to Wayne, a guy that works for me, and she told Wayne that it's not fair. Gary doesn't pay his fair share. Now, she gives me a book that says the 16th Amendment is not legal or lawful, but at the same time, she tells my employee that it's not, that I'm not paying my fair share, and that she has to pay more because of that. So fair share is something that people use when, for whatever reason. Maybe it vents steam when they, after they say it, you know, the steam goes away and they're not as angry as they were before, that they're getting stiffed for large amounts of their effort.
So in other words, it's just rhetoric then?
It's rhetoric, yeah. And it's a well-designed one because people buy into it. You know, they are convinced Well, when you watch the news, they talk about sequestering. You know, some of these reporters are so dense that they think that the local police departments and the road construction and road maintenance will cut back as a kind of an implied threat that you better go along with getting this national budget. And people have told me, you know, you don't pay your taxes, they can't build the roads and they can't maintain them. Well, for the most part, most roads within a town, a county nowadays are built by the developer that develops that, whether it's commercial, industrial, or residential. The guy that builds it has to improve the road from existing well-improved road out to his project, and then all the roads within his project, and he has to bond maintenance for anywhere from a year to 3 years, depending on where you are. But then let's get back to excise taxes, gasoline, batteries, and tires. Those are all used on cars. Therefore, those taxes used to go to the transportation fund within the state and the federal government. Now, the federal government has borrowed excessively from two internal funds, the Social Security Trust Fund and the Federal Highway Transportation Trust Fund. So they stole the money that should be available if they left it untouched to maintain the roads of the United States in better condition than they are now. And Social Security would still be viable if they left that money in there and just got 2 or 3% interest on it over the past many decades. It's true in states, too. The roads are getting worse. California, back when I was a kid, had some of the best roads in the country, and now they've got some of the worst ones. And they had an initiative here a year or two ago, and the initiative was going to be a transportation tax, an increase in the gas tax. And in that legislation, it also required that 40% of the revenues received will go back into roads. Well, hell, all of it was supposed to go back into the roads. And they had to write in the protection for 40% of that. It's kind of absurd when revenue raised for a specific purpose is ripped off by the government to, let's be blunt, pay people that aren't willing to work, provide things for people that aren't willing to do their fair share of effort to build this country. Yeah, this isn't a good use of fair share, isn't it? What's your fair share of the responsibility of this country, those of you who stand in line and receive a check without working for it? Maybe we ought to turn that around on them.
You mean just to clarify, you mean like the welfare state recipients?
Right. Anybody who's getting something for free that they haven't earned. Now, Social Security is earned. Military retirement is earned. Those are the two that the press was talking about in sequestering, wasn't it? They didn't talk about welfare. They didn't talk about free medical. They didn't talk about all these other, the aid to dependent children and all these other things that are giveaway programs that were not earned. They talk about the two that were actually earned, military retirement and Social Security. Military retirement was part of a contract. Now, Congress's contract for retirement, hey, that will go untouched, believe me. But the military, when they signed the contract, that if you serve 20 years, you get a retirement. And it was promised. It was part of the contract. Social Security is based on, it's kind of convoluted how it works, but basically the highest three quarters of your earning determine how much you're going to receive, and you can receive it anywhere from age 62 to 65, and it varies on how much you'll get when you get it, but you paid into it. I paid into it for 48 years of my life. I paid into Social Security. So to take it away from me, but not take it away from somebody that never worked a day in their life, just where's the fair share of their responsibility for this country? There's a good Disney video. This is when Walt was alive, and he was conscientious, and he believed in the United States. He wasn't like what became of Disney after his death, but it's called The Grasshopper and the Ants. If you go to Outpost of Freedom, outpost-of-freedom.com, and then find the link to the library, and then go from there, go to the video library. You can download a cartoon that dates back to, I think, the 40s, maybe even the 30s, could be the 50s. But it demonstrates the responsibility we all have. There is no such thing as a free ride, or there should not be such a thing as a free ride, at least as administered by the government. I'm not saying that charity isn't a good thing. It used to be, it used to take the place of government during the Civil War, what was called the sanitation commissions, privately funded. They were the military hospitals. They provided the bandages, the medicines, the nurses, and everything else. The only thing the military provided was the doctors. And there were a lot of doctors that volunteered in the sanitation societies. That was private funding supplementing the government. Now that whole thing has turned around. The government subsidizes the private doctors. So anyway, let's turn Fear-Sure around on them and start getting responsibility of people who are on the dole.
Right, and unfortunately, the being on the dole and that sort of thing really just reflects a lack of understanding about Tom Stoffel, or to use the actual phrase, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
Well, there is now.
There shouldn't be. I mean, you don't solve the problem of poverty with theft, which actually kind of...
Through history, principled people would not take a handout. And people that wanted to, you know, I read a lot of old history books, diaries, and things like that. People would not take a handout. So people would turn around and say, okay, I'll tell you what, you paint my fence and I'll give you a meal. Okay, I can do that, but I'm not going to take a handout. And this is during the 30s, during the Great Depression, that people then were too proud to accept that they had to live off the efforts of others. They didn't mind being overpaid for it, getting a meal for a little bit of work where the value wasn't there, but they did not like the principle of getting a handout.
Yeah, and just to clarify for everybody, the free market, the real, genuine, laissez-faire free market, non-corporate free market, if you actually look back in history, and I think you were alluding to this a moment ago, there were such things called friendly societies. There was systems of private charity that were in place to provide for the poor, the needy, the widows and their children, et cetera, without having, as some people would say, a gun in the room, not a firearm, the forceful coercion of government. So, which of course the bureaucrats always skim a little bit off the top, which I mean that sardonically, it's never just a little bit off the top. They skim quite a bit. So it doesn't even go to, even if you believe in the welfare state, it doesn't even get to the people that it's intended for and the amounts that it's supposed to be anyway.
So we don't want to go too far astray from the subject, but I will point out that if I can help somebody by giving him some money or overpaying him for some work or something so he can feed his family, which I've done many times in my life, I get a personal feeling of gratification for helping the guy. But when the government takes your money and gives it to people, you don't know who they're giving it to and you don't know what they're using it for, that feeling that we all have in us when we help somebody is removed completely, and we don't appreciate the good feeling we get from giving to people that need it. And that's along the line of what you just said, the government has taken that emotion of doing good away from us and done it collectively and quite often very contrary to what we think should be done with our money. For example, you know, maybe drug testing would be appropriate if people wanted to hand out, but the government is trying to outlaw that minor matter.
Well, of course, the more dependence they have, the more power they have. I mean, that's what it's really about. It's not about caring for the poor or whatever. It's about power, and that and taxation in general gives them more power. I mean, that's what it's all about, which I guess brings us to the next item. Gary, is taxation voluntary?
Well, lawful taxes are not voluntary. They're mandatory. The burden that we talked about, the cost of living in a society. However, is it possible that some taxes are voluntary? And I'm alluding to the one that they call voluntary compliance. I don't like oxymorons, so I took the first word, voluntary, and assumed that to be true and did my research based upon that and found out something interesting, along with other research, that it is voluntary. Income tax, I believe, is voluntary. Now, I can't really assert the truthfulness of what I just said. However, I can demonstrate that it's probably true, and that is because the last time I paid income tax was 1984. I've worked for myself, I've worked for corporations, and I've worked for individuals, and I've not paid taxes since that time. So my conclusion is that is a voluntary tax, and you need not pay it.
Is tax, although in general, though, is taxation theft?
Not when it supports the functions that it's intended to support, the ones that are reasonable, the ones that applied 200 years ago or 150 years ago. Even paying the war debt from the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and even the Civil War. Now, it's not theft when its application is consistent with the powers and authorities that were granted to government by the Constitution. We're speaking specifically the United States now. And so let's go back to salaries for congressmen. It doesn't say anything about retirement. It doesn't say anything about perks. It doesn't say anything about millions of dollars for staff. So that amount that pays the salaries, that amount that maintains the road, that amount that goes to military retirement, and that amount that goes to Social Security payments, and the defense of the country is not theft. Anything beyond that, however, is theft. And where is that line? It's been so muddled over the years, especially because of debt service. But I would say that realistically, probably 10 to 15% of what you pay in taxes is not theft, and the remainder is theft. Now, when I say 10 to 15% of what you pay in taxes, if you're paying 30%, 10% of 30% amounts to 3% of the whole, and 15% would be 4.5% of the whole income. So I would say less than 5% of what you make, what you pay in taxes, is probably, and this would probably be sales tax, city, county, all the taxes, probably somewhere around 5% of what you pay should be sufficient for that specific function of government to operate in the manner that was intended under the ideals of republicanism as was endowed into the original Constitution and the governments of the time. So probably 85 to 90% is theft.
Now, to follow up with that then, do taxes violate the entire notion of property rights?
Not necessarily. However, when you take that much theft and somebody loses his property as a consequence of taxes, and the most common one is what was used to be referred to as a sheriff's sale, where you don't pay your taxes on your property and they take it away from you. Yes, it can be theft of property. Your money is property. The theft portion is definitely in violation of your property rights. Money is property. It's the exchange for labor, and your labor is your property. So that 85% to 90% does violate the notion of property rights, because it is a way of chipping away or chiseling away at my ownership of the property to the point that eventually that whole thing gets eaten up and the property is taken away from me. Not by mortgage, but by taxation.
What, now, earlier this hour, you mentioned direct taxes. So what is the constitutional justification for direct taxes?
Now comes the boring or the exciting part, depending on how you look at it. it was a perplexing question to me. And, you know, I've been studying history for a long time, or trying to. I'm going to read from a book called Ratification. It's written by Pauline Meyer, M-A-I-E-R. It's about the Constitution, but we always hear, oh, those evil people in Philadelphia in 1787 wrote this Constitution and threw it on us, and we had no choice or anything. What they fail to understand is even in the Constitution itself, it requires the ratification of 9 states, which all 13 and every state in the Union has since either ratified or accepted the Constitution. So that argument's moot. But what did happen in those state conventions? And that's what we need to concern ourselves with, because a law is supposed to be intent. When a law is enacted, what was intended when that law was enacted? It's called legislative intent. So I'm going to read you from this Pauline Myers book. She did her research. She went and found the original sources on as many of the state ratifying conventions as she could. And so she, from those discussions, she's sometimes quoted and sometimes paraphrased, but will demonstrate to us what the founders perceived to be the purpose and application of direct taxes. This is in Massachusetts. Federal speakers stressed the advantages to be gained by a strong federal government, which demanded that it have all the tax powers mentioned. Over and over, they insisted that duties on imports, supplemented perhaps by excise taxes, would normally be sufficient to support the central government, which would resort to direct taxes only in time of war. Wow, only in time of war.
Oh, jeez.
Now, there's reason for this. All through history, English history, for example, quite often the king couldn't fight a war unless he could find a way to fund it, and Parliament wouldn't give him the money. So he couldn't fight wars. Okay, now we're going to go to Virginia. So had the issue of federal taxing, the federal taxing power to which, as always, one speaker after another returned, although Virginia's Federalists brought to the discussion a more sophisticated understanding of national finance than characterized most previous debates. For the first time, moreover, they considered in detail the amendment proposed by Massachusetts and South Carolina, and now by James Mason, that would give state legislatures a chance to pay a federal requisition before the federal government imposed a direct tax on the people. So they're opposing the idea of an amendment that would require a requisition first, and then if the state didn't pay the requisition, then they would apply the direct taxes. Pendleton then had already criticized the proposal. Now other Federalists repeated it and added to his arguments. They too said duties on imports would normally be sufficient for federal needs. Congress would resort to direct taxes only in, quote-unquote, great emergencies, such as in time of war, when revenue from imports would decline. Every country, even the oldest and wealthiest, resorted to loans to finance wars which require good credit. So the direct tax, again, Massachusetts and Virginia, only in war, only for war. That's the emergency, the great emergency that would justify taxation. Now we'll go to New York. Experience showed that requisitions were nothing but, quote-unquote, pompous petitions for public charity. Requisitions were pompous petitions for public charity that caused a lot of noise but brought little cash into the treasury. Smith's argument that wartime troubles kept states from paying their requisitions was simply wrong. Those states that suffered most during the war, like New York, felt the most need for federal support and paid the most. Others that were barely touched by war, like New Hampshire, were the most derelict. Direct taxes would not be needed mainly in times of emergency, but the requisition system mandated by the proposed amendment would delay their collection. Probably only half the legislatures, and maybe none of them, would be in session when the money was needed. Once assembled, they might refuse to pay, which would provoke resistance to federal tax collectors and cause internal wars. Those difficulties would undermine federal credit. Quote, what hopes have we of borrowing, he asks, unless we have something to pledge for repayment, end quote. The returns from direct taxes were, quote, the only positive fund, end quote, that could be pledged against the, quote, unquote, extraordinary expenses of, quote, unquote, future wars. New York, as a likely, quote, unquote, theater of war, would be the first to suffer if the new federal government was incapable of defending its people. In short, like many other Federalists, Livingston wanted to secure the new government's capacity to borrow so it could support an army like other contemporary nations. So the argument here is we can't rely on requisitions. The federal government has to have access to direct taxes so that they can borrow money if there is a war. And in New York, which suffered more than most other colonies during the Revolution, well knew the consequences of not having funds available to fight the war. So the direct tax would be the collateral. The ability for the government to collect the direct tax would be the collateral for loans, and they didn't want legislatures standing in the way of keeping them from getting that. So again, we've got war being the reason for direct taxes. And now we'll go to North Carolina, where she talks in terms of kind of a consolidation of some of these ideas on direct taxes. The state ratifying conventions had discussed the issue at length. Federalists insisted that import duties and proceeds from the sale of Western lands would be the primary source of federal revenue. Direct taxes would be needed only in crises such as wars, when the delays caused by requisitioning the states could be fatal. Moreover, if the state legislature refused or neglected to pay the requisitions, that would encourage the people to resist federal tax collectors. Above all, any restriction on federal taxing power would undercut the federal government's capacity to borrow, which was critical in time of war, and keep it in the disreputable financial state that had prompted the federal convention in the first place. Proponents of the amendment sometimes said there could be an exception for wartime. They also insisted the failure of requisitions under the Confederation was irrelevant in judging the amendment's probability of success. The state legislatures would pay requisitions if an action were to bring federal tax collectors into their states and force their constituents to pay both the original requisition and an interest penalty. Supporters of the amendment even argued that the readiness of people to pay, and so the yields from a federal direct tax, would increase if it were levied by the trusted state legislatures rather than the distant Congress. Nobody denied that the new government needed a steady revenue stream for the United States to become a respectable nation. Contenders differed over how to get the necessary funds and over what constituted adequate representation for the purpose of levying direct taxes, which were impossible for individuals to avoid and could be ruinous. Critics of the Constitution were, however, adamant on the tax amendment. They insisted that the people had a right to be taxed only with the consent of representatives who knew them and understood their circumstances in a way that would be impossible for federal congressmen with some 30,000 constituents in Pennsylvania, an informant told Mason in July of 1788. The most sensible, cautious, and artful members of the late opposition were disposed to acquiesce in the establishment of a new government under the Constitution, but they still talked about amendments. And the amendment that they constantly mentioned was the resumption of the power of direct taxation. That was the issue, most clear to members of the opposition, and no other as much fell. Their sensitivity made sense for the people who had fought for the strongest nation in the world on the principles of no taxation without representation, which was for them a critical rights issue. So, here again, we're talking about war. This is in North Carolina. Only direct taxes, only during war. Then when we get to, well, I'll pass that one. It's rather lengthy, but, well, there's three more places in this book where it talks about direct taxes. The intent is to offset extreme emergencies or more specifically, war. When you give government access to your wallet, open and ready access, which the 16th Amendment did, without justification, without the war, without the necessity of that tax, they keep a steady flow of money coming in. Most people today, regardless of their social status, if they're lower middle class, let me back up. When I was a kid, there was an area called Rolling Hills Estates. These are five-acre and larger homes, and they were very expensive homes. And a lot of my friends lived up there. We lived in a little poorer part of town. But these people had trouble paying their bills, even though they were making $40,000 or $50,000 a year, which would probably be the equivalent of close to $1 million a year right now. Because when you have money coming in, you start buying luxury goods. You start spending that money. There's no sense putting it in the bank. You might put some away, but when you've got a lot of money coming in, you tend to buy more. You tend to spend more. You tend to vacation more. And the government does the same thing. They've got this money coming in, so, hey, we've got all this money. Where are we going to spend it? So by giving them the deep pocket through the 16th Amendment, we have created that environment where they can just come and take what they want. And they've gotten to the point now that what they are taking cannot be paid back. That we pay debt service. We don't pay down principal. That means your great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren will still be burdened by the debt being created by the Congress today. Now, taxation without representation 200 years ago was, hey, we don't have a voice in you imposing taxes on us, so we don't want to pay them. My grandchildren have no voice. My great-grandchildren unborn have no voice. But they're being taxed by these idiots in Washington because we have allowed them to reach into our pockets and take whatever they want. And if they can't get by with raising taxes, they'll assign a new name to it. And they're not living in accordance with what was intended by the Constitution, which also wanted fiscal responsibility. It was to pay the debts of the United States, but that was before the era of credit card, where you got your debt limit and then spit to the debt limit, and then you got your debt limit raised so you could spend more. Huh.
Now, just to be clear, when you say when you talk about direct taxes being applied for war, when you say war, you mean like a war that's declared as per Article 1, Section 8, not necessarily the, I guess, what would now be considered the military adventures abroad, correct? Or am I misunderstanding something here?
I mentioned three earlier, and I'll mention them again. The Quasi-French War, and I don't remember exactly the period, but there was a lot of France did have their revolution, and they were in their constant struggle with England, and it was a balancing act. Which side will we side with? And France was barking like a dog, threatening us, and the English were barking like a dog, threatening us. And so, what was called the Quasi-French War, we had more ships of war at sea to protect our shipping because they threatened to seize our shipping. A few different things happened. So to cover these costs, there were some direct taxes implemented on property. Subsequently, in the War of 1812, which we declared on England, that was a declared war, Article 1, Section 8. Congress has the power to declare war, only Congress. That was a declared war, and direct taxes were collected then to offset the cost of that war. The next time we have direct taxes, historically, is the Civil War. Now, that only applied to the North, and it was actually just suppressed rebellion, which you could say is a war because we were fighting a war, army against army. Though, even though it wasn't declared, it was suppression of rebellion, which, there's a debatable issue. But looking at it from the standpoint that the victors looked at it, is suppression of that rebellion was absolutely necessary. It was, in fact, a war, and therefore the direct taxes were assessed and were paid for the war. When the income tax, 1913, the 16th Amendment was passed, and the Federal Reserve Act and the 17th Amendment, by the way, there was a budget, a surplus. Now, understand, dollars are counted differently today than they were then. There was an excess budget of, I believe it was $100 billion in the Treasury. They had $100 billion. And that would have operated the country for many years. Now, then we ran into World War I, and we needed money for that. So it started diminishing that sum. But that would be equivalent of probably $2 trillion nowadays. But the income tax was implemented, and it was a relatively low rate back then, I think under 10%. I don't have the figures in front of me, and stayed that way for a very long time. But even at that low rate, it became a habit. And so the 16th Amendment created this habit, this pattern, of the government being able to reach into our pockets. So then we get World War II, and it goes up, and then it comes down a little after the end of the war. And then we got the Korean War, and it goes up a little bit. We got Vietnam, it went up even more. And then it kind of goes back down and up and down, and every time we have a war, they justify increasing it. After the war is over, it might go down a little bit to make it look like the war is over, but the flow of money still remains. Now, Dwight David Eisenhower, Ike, when he left office, he said, beware the military-industrial complex, because what had happened as a consequence of World War II was this military-industrial complex, the people that built the tanks, the airplanes, and all this, they'd gotten a permanent place in government, and they continued to lobby phenomenal amounts of money to retain that place. The interesting thing about a war is if I fire a bullet, I've got to replace the bullet. If I drop a $10 million or $1 million cruise missile on something, I've got to replace that new missile. And in aviation, you know, I don't know how many experimental aircraft we paid hundreds of millions or billions of dollars for, and they were not functional. The projects got abandoned. But this complex is constantly drawing money out, and it's one of the major sources of a constant flow of revenue out of our pockets. Is it necessary? Probably not. But it's there. But to justify it, we need a war every once in a while. Now, let's see, we had World War II and the Korean War, and in fact, I did some numbers once. When we were the Department of Defense, since we've been the Department of Defense instead of the Department of War, we've had about four times as many wars on an average over a period of time as we did when we were Department of War instead of Department of Defense. So the frequency of wars is becoming great, but it keeps this flow going. And it justifies in the minds of the people that wave flags the willingness to accept an increase in taxes to keep this flow going to the military-industrial concept, especially if a lot of that debt can be laid on our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren.
So what are direct taxes applied to?
Well, back then they were applied to land. In theory, the income tax is a direct tax, but see, it didn't really say that in it, in the 16th Amendment. Which is why I think it's voluntary. I think it's an administrative tax. And I think that, you know, the last 28, 29 years have proven that I'm possibly right. I believe the direct tax at this point in our history only applies to land. And the federal government does not collect taxes on land. So maybe they're still applying the original rules, that it will be on land, and they're just not using it anymore because they found a tricky substitute for it.
All right. Well, is there a difference between necessary and unnecessary government services?
Absolutely. Necessary are ones that were applied to 150, 200 years ago. The unnecessary ones probably exceed by a factor of 20 to 1 today. The unnecessary ones exceed the necessary ones by a factor of about 20 to 1 today, easily.
Wow. Okay. Well,
they got the money, the credit limit's there, and they can raise the credit limit whenever they want. The Federal Reserve will loan them anything they want as long as they give them a bunch of cash that they can borrow. They give the Federal Reserve the cash, and then they borrow it back from them. So as long as they can keep, politicians want two things, wealth and power. This all through the history of the world, wealth and power. There are very few exceptions, and these guys in Washington want wealth and power. So they'll do anything. And so the unnecessary services become a part of their acquisition of wealth and power.
Well, on that note, we are going to go to break. So everyone, you know, get up, walk around a little bit, do what you need to do, and we will return momentarily. Good Talk Radio takes a lot of effort to make it successful. It is truly a labor of love to bring high-quality episodes of OPF Radio to your digital music player. However, we do need to meet our operating expenses. We are a completely independent media who are entirely supported by our listeners. So we are not beholden to either corporate special interests or unscrupulous advertisers who would use us to push their products. If you believe in our mission to bring original and useful material to the Patriot community, please consider making a donation today. Thank you so much for making this outreach effort worthwhile for all of us.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
Now the ride of Paul Revere set the nation on its ear, and the shock at Lexington heard round the world. When the British fired in the early dawn, the War of Independence had begun. The die was cast, the rebel flag unfurled, and on to Concord marched the foe to seize the arsenal there, you know, waking folks and searching all around. Till our militia stopped them in their tracks. At the old North Bridge, we turned them back and chased those redcoats back to Boston town. And the shout heard around the world was the start of the revolution. The men were ready on the move. Take your powder, take your gun, report to General Washington. Hurry, men, there's not an hour to lose. Now at famous Bunker Hill, even though we lost, it was quite a thrill. The rebel Colonel Prescott proved he was wise. Outnumbered and low on ammunition, as the British stormed his position, he said, hold your fire till you see the whites of their eyes. Though the next few years were rough, General Washington's men proved they were tough. Those hungry, ragged boys would not be beat. One night they crossed the Delaware, surprised the Hessians in their lair, and at Valley Forge they just bundled up their feet. Now the shot heard round the world,
it was
the start of the revolution. The men were ready on the move. Take your blanket, take your son, report to General Washington. We've got our rights and now it's time to prove. Well, they showed such determination that they won the admiration of countries across the sea like France and Spain, who loaned the colony ships and guns and put the British on the run and the Continental Army on its feet again. And though they lost some battles too, the Americans swore they'd see it through. Their raiding parties shipped up, hit and run. At Yorktown, the British could not retreat. Bottled up by Washington and the French fleet. Cornwallis surrendered, and finally we had won.
Hooray!
On the shot heard round the world, the end of the revolution. The Continental rabble took the day, and the father of our country beat the British there at Yorktown and brought freedom to you and me and the USA. God bless America.
And that was The Shot Heard Around the World by Schoolhouse Rock. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this broadcast of Outpost of Freedom Radio. Tonight, we are asking the question, taxes, what are they for? We are taking calls at this time. The call-in number is area code 530-576-5790. One more time, 530-576-5790. Alternatively, you can add user OPF Radio if you happen to have Skype, or you can simply type your question into the listener chat room, and I will read them for you on the air. And while we wait for all those lovely questions, comments, and hopefully even calls, Gary, is it proper to you? Now, I know before the break, we were talking a bit about the welfare state and people not understanding that there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. So to really ram this home, then, Gary, is it proper to use taxes or tax revenue to provide, to ostensibly provide for charity?
Well, the The preamble to the Constitution says promote the general welfare. It doesn't say provide the general welfare. But welfare has taken on a new meaning, and it's been redefined to include charity, and promote has been redefined to provide. No, absolutely not. There was no intention on the part of the founders. They recognized churches and private societies were quite adequate to provide for those in need. And it was personal, and it was direct, and it also provided incentive for people to do better. It gave them a foot up, so to speak. But no provision in our Constitution makes can in any way be construed to justify charitable contributions, if you want to call them contributions, by the government. They simply buy power and authority, influence.
Now, our tax. Now, before the break, also, you were mentioning about the military-industrial complex and the relationship between direct taxes and war. So, are taxes now allocated towards supporting essentially the warfare state, the military-industrial complex?
Well, if you looked at the military side of the budget and took the salaries and necessary expenses of keeping an army in the field, in all the fields, let me take that back, all the fields, and looked at maintaining existing equipment, I would guess that you'd probably be looking at less than half of the Defense Department budget. The rest of that is going into the military-industrial complex for replacement of those cruise missiles expended absent a declaration of war by Congress, and also in the research and development arm where they're constantly designing new planes, some of which might even fly. So, yes, there is a near permanent – at this point in time, there is a near permanent allocation to the military-industrial complex, and it will not be sequestered, I can assure you.
Yeah, and you see, as a bit of a side note about the total military spending, it's funny. Conservative statists will be correct to a certain degree that – federal domestic spending on social insurance schemes and welfare entitlement benefits do exceed total military spending, but then they also conveniently neglect to mention that total military spending has increased exponentially at least since 2000. I think the figures are something about from approximately $300 billion to over $700 billion. And a lot of that, correct me if I'm wrong here, but a lot of that is from tax revenue.
Well, or debt. I think that you'll find, too, if you scrutinize the budget, a lot of the research and development might be couched in other areas that might not be defined directly as military. They used to be, and I'm not familiar with the budget now, but it used to be the research and development was carried in the provision of the government. But the government has got, or the budget, but the government's gotten rather creative at hiding things. To make them appear that they don't exist, or they're less than they are, or various methods of deception.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of many accounting tricks and all that are such things like CAFRs, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, and many other types of government documents where they'll that don't make it into certain typical reports that you get from either usually GAO, the General Accounting Office, or other types of government agencies. So yeah, there is a lot of deceptive accounting, and of course, probably the best deceptive accounting is probably the non-existent accounting regarding the Federal Reserve, but again, that's something for another time. So,
the CAFRs, I don't know that anybody has adequately explained the CAFRs yet.
That's fair.
Even Van Buren, who's done an excellent job of exposing them, you just wonder where all these phenomenal numbers come from. So, yeah, they're good at hiding things.
Yeah, and if it's not CAFRs, there's usually just other things. I mean, the government's very, very deceptive. Or one of the things I keep coming across is the what's it called? Like the melting pot theory of taxation, where like there's no, like you can't figure out as a unfortunate, pardon the expression, but a hapless citizen, you can't really figure out what portion of your taxes are being allocated to what. So it's like all fusing like this melting pot thing. And then, you know, then we have the quote unquote paying your fair share problem.
I do pay my fair share.
Well, are permits and licensure just another kind of tax, though?
Yes. No. Let's look at a permit. A permit is permission to do something. Say, use the public park, and they charge a fee for that. That's directed. It's kind of a one-time tax, so that they can clean up afterwards, and you know, maybe if they surplus, they can use it for the improvement of the park or something like that. But when we get to building permits, they've become a source of revenue rather than a use fee. Now, normally a permit would have been a use fee. Now, as I mentioned earlier, $30,000 for the permits to build a house, plus the cost of construction, the roadway, the sidewalks, everything. So they have been abused. They have been converted into another source of revenue for the government. Licensure, another license by definition is the right to do something that would otherwise be illegal. They use it for driver's licenses, and they use it for marriage licenses and fishing licenses and hunting licenses. And if you go back in history, you'll find some interesting things. One on hunting licenses, for example, the Supreme Court in a ruling once said that, I think it was Wyoming, could charge out-of-state hunters a license fee to hunt in Wyoming during hunting season because they had to pay their share of the cost of the wildlife department or the game and fish and game department or whatever Wyoming had at the time. But the state residents paid it as part of their regular taxes. Therefore, they could not pay, would not have to pay the license fee, which made sense because you've got visitors coming in. They've got to pay, you know, a fair share to be able to hunt when it's being maintained by the citizens of Wyoming. Marriage license, well, we'll be talking about that in the verbicide discussion in the near future, so I won't go there. But a driver's license has become a source of revenue. In fact, it became so burdensome that most states have extended the period, the term of the license, because people were waiting hours in line every year in some states to renew their license. The license tags on the car, the same thing. But they have become a source of revenue, especially the license and the tags on the car. And referring to a California decision from the early 19-teens, the California Supreme Court ruled that electric vehicles can pay a licensing fee because they have to participate in the money for the repair of roads and bridges. However, gasoline-powered vehicles could not be licensed then because every time they drove up to the gas pump, they paid their share of the maintenance in the roads and bridges. So when you have an exception that doesn't pay its fair share of a specific use, it's one thing. But now it's become a source of revenue, and the tag fee on my truck, which is 6 years old, cost more than a pickup truck cost brand new when I was a kid. I mean, it's gotten out of hand. It's a source of revenue. California, this is back in the 80s, had Richard McDonald brought these figures to light. California had committed 28 years in the future to vehicle registration fees, license fees. They borrowed against 28 years into the future of motor vehicle registration license fees. So it's become a source of revenue and actually a collateral. I don't know where they are now. They're probably 50 or 60 years in the future because they're doing just what the federal government does. Maybe they're to the point that they can never pay it off, just like the federal debt. So properly applied, perhaps, but let's look at licensure versus certification. airplane pilots are certified. They have to retain currency, but unless and until they do something that causes them to lose that certification, they're assumed to still be qualified. But the annual license fee becomes revenue because it's charged every year. Now, do I forget how to drive, or do I become a better driver over time and experience? So why would I have to renew every year if it wasn't for revenue or a form of tax, as opposed to that I get a certificate that I can drive these type of automobiles, for example, and unless and until I do something to prove that I'm not no longer qualified, like have an accident and not restitute, and I cause it and not restitute the damaged party, then they could take it away. But so yes, it is it been converted to a form of taxation, and it has defied the decisions of earlier Supreme Courts or courts regarding what licensure is.
Yeah, and as a little bit of a side note on that, you know, I find it, you mentioned Obamacare earlier, and I find it very, not necessarily sad, but revealing, and I want to leave it up to the audience how they want to interpret this, but I find it very revealing that a lot of the rhetoric coming from the Tea Partiers, many of whom I believe were genuine, regarding Obamacare, you know, the main line, for those who don't know, the main line about we're being forced to pay for a product we don't want, health insurance, if you will, supposedly, that like this is some new thing, because anybody that has a car, which is pretty much, I would probably argue, probably most citizens here in these United States, you have to pretty much pay a, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe you have to pay like a like mandatory, you know, car insurance. So now, sure, they give you your, you still have some little liberty with choosing which provider you want, but a lot of states in the union require you to, Texas definitely does, require you to actually buy car insurance. And if you don't buy car insurance, well, you're just really trying to push the mala prohibita line, which is kind of unfortunate. So in a lot of ways, a lot of people are already paying, being forced to pay for products they would otherwise not pay for. So I just find that very revealing. Now, we did get a comment from Evenhand in the chat room. He asks, how can a person avoid the point of sale sales tax charged immediately at the sale?
Well, that's there may be some tricks to do that. I'll give you an idea, though. Orange County, Florida raised their sales tax on new cars or automobiles, cars, new and used. And I think it was Lake County just west of Orlando all of a sudden got a surge of car buyers, and Orange County car dealers went back to the county and said, hey, take that sales tax away because we're losing all our business. But there is no way that I know to avoid it unless you're exempt. Now, exemption is a privilege that extends to charitable institutions, and it extends in some cases, and this comes down to an IRS issue that my stepfather was involved in a Supreme Court or a tax court decision many years ago on. He was buying solvent, and they were charging him sales tax on the solvent, but he argued and prevailed that solvent became a part of the finished product, therefore he did not have to pay sales tax on it. So if you're a charitable institution, or you can get an exemption for a certain thing because it's something that's going to be resold, then you can avoid the point of sales tax. Beyond that, I don't know of any way of doing it unless you just say, look, I'll give you the $9.95 and go soak your head for the taxes.
Now, you mentioned Social Security earlier in that it was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you said it was earned. I have to ask, though, isn't Social Security just another tax?
Well, it didn't start out that way. It was a contribution. I don't remember exactly what it was called, but it was a contribution that went into a specific fund to be returned. You could say it was a tax, in that respect. But again, it was a singular purpose, and it was supposed to go in, and your Social Security account kept track of this, and then at a certain point you got it back. It was an old age retirement fund. Old age retirement, not disability, not dependent children's funds, but an old age retirement fund. It wasn't intended initially that if you died young, your children would be able to go to college, because you probably couldn't have sent them to college if you lived longer, which it has become. It didn't become a disability insurance program. Anything beyond that you could begin collecting early at a reduced rate, but now the rate can be as high as if you were had gone the whole 65 years. So it's changed its nature over time. Is it a tax? Yes, but it was a specific purpose, and you got a direct return as a consequence of your contribution to that tax. So, yes, it was a tax, but very specific initially. Now, over the years, there are changes to what the Social Security Act that have removed it from even having an obligation to you if they want to remove that obligation.
So if I'm understanding you right, what you're saying is that originally it was supposed to be basically what, a pension?
Basically a pension, but being collected by the government, it was mandatory, and it was like a tax. Interestingly, though, it was a tax that applied to you and your employer. He paid the same amount that you did. He made a contribution, which basically made both contributions, because if he pays $10 a month into it, he could have paid you the $10 instead of them. But it was kind of put a burden on your employer to collect the thing, tax, I guess. But it was supposed to be a pension if you met certain conditions back then, initially. The old age retirement fund.
We got another question from the chat room from 1800 Ill Kill. He asks, isn't the Federal Reserve 100-year charter up this year?
Well, first, the Federal Reserve is not the topic tonight. Taxes are. And second, I think it is, and I'm sure that it will be renewed. It might be revised. That's just a guess. I haven't looked into it, but my understanding was the charter was for 100 years when it was enacted in 1913.
Right, and because that is not the subject for tonight, the only other thing I will add to that is, and I believe the link man will put this in the chat room, but for those of you listening later on the podcast version, if you go to YouTube and type in Divide and Conquer, you should Outpost of Freedom, should be able to get the playlist up on our YouTube channel, which... and it's specifically the installment called Central Banking, and will kind of educate you as to certain pitfalls that come from focusing exclusively on the Federal Reserve at this time.
And yeah, that's futility.
At this time, and there are links to the original Divide and Conquer article if you actually want to read it, but for those who prefer to listen, it's up on YouTube. So Divide and Conquer, the Central Banking installment. Now, back to taxes.
Let me make an apology, too. If I said Obamacare earlier, I sincerely apologize, because I don't like saying that O word, but I should have said the Bastard President Care Program. And so my apologies for saying that other word, care.
Fair enough. All right, continuing on, back to taxes. Does anybody have an obligation to pay taxes?
Well, let's look at three categories here. Yes, you have an obligation to pay those taxes that are justified by the Constitution and the legislative and the government acting within its proper authority. No, you have no obligation to pay taxes that are above and beyond that. However, there are consequences for not paying those. For example, property tax, which used to support schools, now supports wealth of people unwilling to work, and they will take your house away from you. So you're kind of – they're using force to steal your money And if you don't let them steal your money, they'll steal your property. So obligation for the ability to retain your property, I don't know if you'd call it obliged or forced to, but somewhere obliged / forced to. And then the third category is what I believe true about the income tax is it doesn't apply to me, and therefore I don't have to pay it. So the third one, no, income tax, I see no obligation to pay it or play their silly paperwork game. You know, this today is the holiday that I stopped celebrating 29 years ago, and I kind of enjoy not celebrating this holiday. Everybody else celebrates by getting drunk after they realize how much money they had to pay into the system, by being ecstatic because they got to the post office at the time, by spending months coming up to this date as if in anticipation of Christmas coming when you're a child. Not quite the same way, though. But those are the three types. One, you do have a moral obligation to sustain what is necessary for you to contribute.
And looks like we're having a bit of a technical issue. Just
willingly pay that contribution, that voluntary compliance tax.
Yes, and we're going to get a little bit more into that in just a little bit here with why people have the association that you just mentioned about with the 15th. Because, I mean, yes, I know that today is technically tax day. And actually, we've actually already done this before technically with at least mentioning it as tax day on a previous episode of YHTOM, You Have Tread on Me, which is actually in the archives here at OPF Radio. So if you want to go listen to that, it's in the archives. But yeah, today is tax day. And actually, before I forget, I would like to wish everybody in 4 days, on the 19th, Happy Patriots Day, which is a real holiday, which is a positive holiday.
Shipped in Massachusetts, where they made it a Monday holiday and was celebrated today with a bomb going off.
Oh, touche. But yeah, if we're going to have holidays or whatever, I would rather we have holidays that are with the glass, at least the glass half full, that are positive. And so, yeah, it's you know, it's kind of like people thinking that, you know, celebrating 9/11 or something. No. Stop with 9/11. Stop with tax day. Let's have our own good holidays. We can start with Patriots Day on the 19th of April. Which is at least a starting point. So we have another, I guess this is more of a comment from Evenhand. And if I'm understanding the context of this, I think this was relating earlier to when we were talking about the relationship between direct taxes and war. Evenhand says, good freaking point. Maybe the reason there has not been any war bond drives is because there has not been a formally declared war since World War II.
Well, that's the point. Now, war bonds were a lower interest rate than borrowing from the banks, and it was borrowing from the people. The return on them was substantially lower than what would have paid the banks to borrow the money during World War II. It also served a moral value that I'm contributing to the war effort, and I think that Roosevelt was a pretty sly dude. And so I think that the war bonds, even though they were only part of what paid for the war, was that moral issue that once you buy war bonds, then you got to be behind the war because you have contributed to it. So psychological.
What is the, now there's been some semantic issues, I guess would be the best way to put it, regarding dealing with taxes. So let's address that. Gary, what is the difference between tax resistance, tax rebellion, and tax protesting?
Well, I've been called all three, but as long as I'm not called late for dinner, I don't really give a darn. But tax resistance is resisting taxes. Tax Rebellion is a name that the Internal Revenue Service assigned back in the 70s to those who were not paying their taxes or were resisting the Internal Revenue Service. And tax protesters is really a misnomer. Well, I guess some people protest taxes verbally, but for some reason it's become the most common one. Back in the late 80s when I was on the Prodigy, which was the pre-internet communication system, we had a tax board. And we discussed there, the shills kept calling me an illegal tax protester. And I corrected their grammar and replied that, yes, I was. I said, yes, I am a, quote, illegal tax, end quote, protester. I protest illegal taxes because I consider the Internal Revenue Service tax illegal. Rebellion is what the government wants to call it. I don't know if they thought they really muster a suppressed rebellion movement by calling it rebellion. But resistance is probably the correct name because we are those of us that have now a lot of people are in prison for resisting incorrectly, but we're resisting what we consider an unlawful tax. There was another group of people in the 60s, the war tax protesters, I think, is what they went by. But they were resisting the war in Vietnam by putting money in bank accounts, escrow accounts, the equivalent of their taxes, saying that once the war is over, we'll give you the money. However, the federal government went to the bank and said, give us the money now, and they did. So it was very ineffective, the initial efforts at that. But the proper term is probably tax resistor, but it's hard to say. I mean, we basically developed a slang around this. I don't want to call it an industry, but it is because it's, you know, it serves to provide more for me than without it. But imagine if you made $100,000 a year and you had to pay $30,000 in taxes, you only get $70,000 a year. And imagine if you made $100,000 a year and don't pay taxes and you get $100,000 a year, I get almost 50% more than you do for the same work. So that's the sort of an industry. But, you know, what you call it doesn't matter. What you need to understand about it is what I'm explaining here. But I will go a little further. There is risk and there's a lot of learning required before you ever get to the position that I took in 1985 by refusing to participate in the game. Look at it this way. If I'm playing Monopoly, I'm bound by the rules of Monopoly. If I'm watching a game of Monopoly, I'm not bound by the rules of Monopoly. So you're playing the tax game, you've got to abide by the rules. But if you're not, if you're just watching the tax game, not bound by the rules.
Well, on that note, is tax protesting even effective?
Well, there's two sides of effective. One is it changing things? No, not a bit. It's not effective at all in getting rid of an unlawful law. Well, it might not be unlawful. It's not an illegal law. It's an unlawful law. But is it effective? Yes, because since I don't have to part with all that money, look at how much better. An example, from 93 to 95, I was traveling around the country. My savings got dropped.
Gary? It looks like we might be having some technical problems. So just bear with us for a moment. This is it's something that does happen occasionally, so nothing to worry about. But yeah, it's I don't know. It almost seems like there's a It almost seems as if there's people who think that tax protesting means to protest taxes, not not the how it's legally defined by like Ballantines, Bouviers, or Blacks, but think that what it entails is waving a cardboard sign on a street corner. So,
let's try that again. Where were we when that cut off?
Is tax protesting effective?
Is not effective in getting rid of illegal or unlawful laws. They're probably legal, but they're probably unlawful. It is effective, as I said, that I started over. I started from scratch. I had very little in 1995 when I went back to work. Now I own my own home, two cars, and everything else. And I probably could not have achieved that had I made my voluntary compliance contribution to the federal government for those 16 years since I had to go back and work and rebuild my retirement and all of that. So as far as providing me a comfortable living, it has been very effective. So no, it won't change things, but yes, if you do it. Now, it could change things if enough people did it, I suppose, because look at it this way. If that money is going to pay people unwilling to work for a living, you know, those that won't do their fair share, what if enough people that will do their work for a living stop contributing to those that won't work for a living? That would leave only those that don't work for a living as contributors to the system that provides them a living without working for, which means they can no longer not work for a living and survive, if you can follow that.
Yes, 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 I can.
And, but it has to be a movement that grows, and the IRS does everything they can to advertise. You know, this is the time of year you'll see people get busted for tax evasion and all this stuff. The government will do everything they can to keep that from being effective in causing an effective change in the way things work.
Now, just a moment ago, when there was a bit of difficulty there, I briefly mentioned that some people think that tax protesting means to protest taxes, not in the sense like how it's legally defined in, like, you know, law dictionaries such as Ballantines, Bouviers, Blacks, etc., where you're either just not filling out forms or something on that angle, but think what that means is to demonstrate on the street, i.e. go on a street corner and wave a cardboard sign around. So just to be clear, when we're talking about tax protesting, what do you mean by that?
Well, I didn't coin the term, nor did I coin the term hippie, but I was called one. But generally speaking, those three terms, the government called them tax rebels. They considered themselves more of tax resistors. And the people that were attacking us called us tax protesters. I don't care what you call me, but for all intents and purposes, it's kind of a slang attachment to people that don't agree that the government has the right to reach into our pocket and grab that money and pull it out whenever they want to. So you're correct. We're not using the term protest in a proper dictionary application. We are using it in a context that was assigned to it out of circumstances of the time. They wanted to call it something. They wanted it to be derogatory. They said we're tax protesters. Remember, the war protesters were attacked the same way. They were called war protesters. They weren't protesting in a legal or a technical definition sense, but they were protesting the war in Vietnam, so the term probably carried over effectively to the tax protesters as well. So I don't, like I say, I don't care what they call me, but I am protesting quote-unquote illegal taxes.
Now, is tax, for lack of a better term, is tax protesting illegal?
Tax protesting illegal? Yes and no. Obviously, it's not illegal for me because I figured it out. Is it illegal for other people? Well, they've ended up in prison. Some have died in prison. Their terms were so long. The people in Florida common law court trial, the tax protest segment of that group, spent 12 years in prison, and it had nothing to do with taxes. Interestingly, there's people like Dan Meter, Larkin Rose, and a few other well-known people in the anti-tax movement, for want of another term, that have gone to prison, but generally the charges against them, and I think the best example is Larkin Rose. He wasn't charged with not paying his taxes. He wasn't charged with failure to file. He wasn't charged with anything related to taxes. He was charged something along the lines of encouraging people to defraud the government. Some weird charge like that. Now, how can you encourage people to defraud the government? But he was convicted and spent a couple of years in prison, I think, as a consequence. So most of these people that are tax protesters, using the generic that term, when they go to prison, has nothing to do with taxes. They find some other way of getting them because they're afraid to challenge these people on the tax code because they might lose. And if they lose, then that becomes a problem that begins to spread like wildfire. There's a guy named, Tennessee, what was his name? Lloyd Long. He went to jury trial with the IRS, and he convinced the jury that he had no obligation to pay taxes, using the government's witnesses primarily to prove that point. The jury found him, acquitted him of the charges of tax evasion and failure to file. The government decided they didn't want to appeal that decision because if they appealed it, and if it was upheld by the appellate court, it would become stare decisis, and it would be the working model for anybody to avoid paying taxes in the future. So it's illegal, or it's stupid not to defend yourself properly if you take the position that you have no obligation for taxes. The illegal part is encouraging people to defraud the government or some obscure law that is what they usually go after. But I can't see that it's illegal because I pay all legal taxes.
All right, so just to clarify the point, is there such a thing as an quote unquote illegal tax protester?
No. There is a quote illegal tax end quote protester, but not an illegal quote illegal tax protester end quote.
Okay, and then I guess the next follow up to that is it illegal to not pay taxes?
Well, I think another form of the same question, but to me, no. If you do it properly, it is not illegal. If you do it improperly, let me put it this way. When you fill out a W-4, you have made yourself a taxpayer and promised the government that they get their fair share of your money. Now, if you offer them that money, let's look at charity. If you make a pledge to a charity, that pledge is enforceable in court. If I pledge $100,000 to a charity in good faith, I'm not intoxicated on drugs, then I make a pledge, but then I decide not to pay them, they can actually take me to court for that and will probably win unless my circumstances have changed so drastically that I couldn't possibly pay it. If I promise the government that I'm going to pay them taxes when I fill out the W-4 and the 1040, then I'm bound by that pledge, voluntary compliance. I'm bound by that pledge to pay them. And if I do not pay them after I promise to pay them, it does become illegal to not pay taxes. So the idea is to avoid promising the government that you're going to pay the taxes, and then it is not illegal to not pay taxes. But if you promise to pay, it is illegal to not pay the taxes.
Now, I got two questions sent to me over Skype, actually, and since I usually presume that anything done that way is usually private, I will not name the handle of the individual asking this. The first one is, what do you, this is in reference to earlier before the break. First question is, what do you mean by voluntary compliance?
I don't know. It's an oxymoron. If you look at it this way, if I what I just said, if I volunteer to pay taxes, I've volunteered to comply. If I fill out a W-4, I've volunteered to pay taxes, so I've volunteered to comply. I've somehow removed it from the oxymoronic state it came to me in. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, probably. And actually, something I just thought of for the link man, and as well as for everyone listening later on the podcast version, if you go to YouTube, do a search for first name's Jan Heldfield. I believe that's H-E-L-F-E-I-L-D, if I remember how to spell it. Jan Heldfield and Harry Reid. And Mr. Heldfield did an interview, brief interview with Harry Reid on exactly pretty much the primary question is, what do you mean by voluntary compliance when it comes to taxes? And Harry Reid could not answer the question. It was about as simple as it comes. So this has been addressed before. So even the government, or at least an agent thereof, the legislator in this case, could not answer the question in a simple, direct, and clear manner.
Well, I got, you know, I got paid, contracted to write an article once. It was back in the probably the mid-90s, and I've been looking around and I can't find the article, but somebody contacted me and sent me an article that was an interview done in the national newspaper with the new head of the IRS. Now, that's an office that changes fairly rapidly, it seems like. They've always got somebody else in there. But this lady, had been being questioned, had said, basically, if the burden was put on the IRS to prove the obligation of the taxpayer to pay them, that the Internal Revenue Service would go broke enforcing the laws, and he contracted me to write an article on that. But think of the absurdity of that. If the burden, the legal burden, which we expect in the judicial system in this country, if the legal burden were put on the IRS to prove the burden that you had a burden or an obligation to pay taxes, they would go broke trying to collect the taxes. Now, think about that. That's what the then director, I think her name was Sharon something, the then director of the Internal Revenue said back in the 90s. If they had the legal obligation to prove that you had an obligation to pay taxes, they would go broke. They might as well close their doors and go home. Now, I think that says a lot about what voluntary compliance is, and the only way, as I just said, that I can construe voluntary compliance is once I volunteer to comply, I'm bound to comply. And then it becomes illegal to not comply.
Well, I guess the follow-up question to the one on voluntary compliance is, what is the difference between voluntary compliance and paying your fair share? Or I guess maybe a better way of asking the question is there a difference between the two?
Well, voluntary compliance is oxymoronic, let me put it that way. But, however, if I promise to pay my fair share, if I volunteer to pay my fair share, if I volunteer that contribution, then I suppose that my fair share is what I've agreed to, which is what the tax code says I can do, including the obligation and the deductions. So, if you accept the premise that you are going to voluntarily comply, then I guess you have also assumed a degree of recognition of the concept of fair share that I refuse to recognize either.
Now, what can help lower someone's tax liability?
Do what I did, and the only other one is to take advantage of the loopholes that are put in the tax code. And those loopholes are put in the tax code under pressure from people that have found divisive ways of avoiding paying their fair share, even though they've volunteered to comply. You would have to go to H&R Block or somebody like that or read the tax code itself. I can't help you there. Years ago, I knew some of the tricks. I talked to somebody recently. He made a bunch of money last year, but this year he made very little. There was a trick that I knew some clients of mine used. It's called Schedule G. It was a father and two sons. So one year the father ran the business and got this big paycheck. The next year the big paycheck went to son A, and the father had just about no income that year, very small. So he filed a Schedule G, which averages last year's income with this year's income, and reduced his tax liability drastically. He actually got money back. And then the next year it goes to son B, and the year after that it goes to the father. So Schedule G is one way if you can adjust your income. Now, the IRS tried to get these guys, and I don't think they ever did, but I think they got worried after a while and finally stopped doing it. But they never got busted for it. But then, you know, the tax code changes over the years. It used to be that any interest you paid was removed from your earned income. So if you paid $10,000 in interest and made it $90,000, you really only made $80,000 that was taxable. But they've whittled away at that, and now I think the only thing that's deductible is the interest paid on your primary home. But it used to be all the stuff you paid on credit cards would come off, but credit, you know, that cost the government millions of dollars a year. Billions, probably. But lowering your liability, one is to play the game and read the rules and follow the rules and find the loopholes and take advantage of the loopholes. And the other one is to not to lower your tax liability, but to remove it altogether, as I've done.
Now, how risky is it to not pay the federal income tax?
Oh, I'm scared to death after 29 years that they're going to come and arrest me and charge me with failure to file and tax evasion and all that. You know, I tremble every night when I go to bed. Oh, wait, no, I guess it's not risky after all this time. Okay, let's look at the numbers. I paid into Social Security 48 years. I've not paid into Internal Revenue Service for 29 years, or about 60 or 65% of that time. So I don't think there's any risk involved, but again, it's absolutely necessary. And let's talk about what used to be called the turkey shoot. They used to put the turkeys behind a log, and the shooter would get up on the line, and he would have to gobble and get the turkey to shoot it, stick his head up, and then he'd shoot the turkey's head off, and he got the turkey if he hit the turkey. He paid, so you know, 25 cents for a shot. If he got the turkey, he got the turkey. He got a good deal. If he missed, he didn't get the turkey. He could try again. What I call the tax protesters turkey shoot is if you do it wrong, you might get your head shot off. I've studied for a long time, not that long really, because 4 years. I studied for 4 years, and I finally, not by anybody's, Phil Marsh had the pilot connection. There were a bunch of programs out there, and I read all them, and I didn't feel comfortable with them. Most of them required you doing paperwork on Internal Revenue Form. And my feeling was, this isn't quite right. I just want to walk away from this. I don't want to play Monopoly, I guess is the thought that was in my head. But you have to understand why you were playing Monopoly, why you don't want to play anymore, what you have to do to assure that you're not playing anymore. You have to understand the concept behind it. Now, I will give, if the link man can find the link for Ashwander versus TVA, this is probably instrumental in understanding the concept that I just mentioned. Now, I'm not going to stick my head up and start online teaching people how to avoid paying taxes they have no obligation to pay, because I don't want to feel responsible if somebody doesn't grasp it and thinks they got it and end up in prison. However, I will suggest that if you read Ashwander versus TVA, the article on my blog, and read it very carefully and understand that the Internal Revenue Service is an administrative agency, you are on the road to health and success.
Understood. All right. Now, I guess kind of on the same train of thought, a manner of speaking, And I guess this kind of plays a little bit into the last episode we did to some degree. How effective are tax shelters at keeping wealth out of reach of the Internal Revenue Service?
Well, people with a lot of money set up lobby for tax shelters so they can protect their wealth. Now, poor people can't. They usually can't afford to get into them. There are certain types of trusts that reduce tax liability substantially, but unless you've got a lot of money, it's not worth the cost inherent in developing those trusts. There are other, let's say, gaps in tax shelters that people have found, and they've used them, but then the IRS will come along and get Congress to pass another law that closes those loopholes. But I suppose that there are some, if they're the ones that are used by the wealthy people who have designed them for their benefit, if you attach yourself to one of those, you can reduce your liability and perhaps protect your property. One of the people convicted in Florida Common Law Court trial, I'm not going to mention his name because he's kind of left the movement after 12 years in prison, but he set up a trust for people. They didn't break the trust. They got some people to complain that the trusts were in violation, so he was convicted because of some obscure thing, not specific to the trust, but that people said he took their money and didn't produce, something to that effect. So he spent a couple years in prison. In fact, he was still in prison there when he was charged with Florida Common Law Court. His term was up. He got out of prison, and then he went to Florida to stand trial there and got his 12 years there. But he had set up these trust tax shelters, and they were effective. The IRS did not breach them. It's just back to the people that don't do it right got him in trouble, which is what I'm not going to do. And he also stuck his head up by doing that because they were effective tax shelters. But see, that's playing by the rules, and I don't know, I forgot how to play Monopoly. There's something about do not pass go, do not collect $200, and I don't like that corner of the board, so I don't play Monopoly anymore, and so I'm not really versed on what is current now. I haven't looked at it for 29 years.
Yeah, and just for the audience, just so they can understand the magnitude of taxes as they are, I guess, levied today. I guess that's the right word, the right verb. From what was brought to my attention is that more or less, the federal tax code seems to be approximately on the order of about 73,000 plus pages, or I think it was like 25 volumes. I mean, it's absolutely huge.
When I counted words on a page once, and I had used to have the U.S. code, and I counted the words on the page and then the number of pages, and I think I came up with over 2 million words. The Constitution is only 4,000 words. It created a country, and we've got 2 million words on loopholes. One of my favorites, though, this is trying to recollect back then, and it was 2011 or 2001, a section number, but it was definition of a taxpayer, and this is great. The definition of a taxpayer, as best I recall, is any person who has an obligation to pay taxes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it kind of begs the question, who has an obligation to pay taxes?
Right, but see, they never answered that. And that was one of the early, that was discussed a lot back then. And some people might have successfully avoided it as long as they didn't stick their head up. But the foundation for me is I am not a taxpayer. I am not a taxpayer, period. That's all there is to it. I am not a taxpayer.
Now, here's probably the penultimate question, then, Gary. Can government exist without taxes?
Absolutely not. It cannot exist without taxes. What, is government going to set up a business entity? You know, okay, we're going to sell widgets so that we can support the government and build your roads and provide your protection from foreign invasion? No, it cannot. The Constitution, however, was designed and intended to provide for a minimum of government. Those things I read earlier from the ratification book by Pauline Maier, they were talking about only in time of war, the normal business of government, imposts and duties. They perceived that imposts and duties was sufficient to run the general government under normal circumstances. And we can look at, I didn't get the quote, but I'll paraphrase it. Alexander Hamilton, the lead Federalist, the strongest Federalist, he said that commerce is the primary beneficiary of government. Now, understand then, as now, but then it was sailing ships. You had ships that carried merchandise to foreign ports and sold it and then brought merchandise or raw products back here. That commerce was absolutely necessary. Why do we need a navy? To protect that Congress. Ask Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates. Who benefits most? The interstate highway system. Most of the traffic on that, weight-wise, is trucks carrying goods from here to there. Commerce benefits from the wonderful system of government that was developed out of the Constitution. Still, with all the abuses of government, commerce is the primary beneficiary of the products of government, the justified ones. So who should the burden of taxation fall upon? And that's what Hamilton said, it should be commerce, because they are the primary beneficiary of most of the services of government. Now, if that's the case, well, people will argue, well, if it's on commerce, you're going to pay it anyway. Yes, I will. But they used to have, in the early 1900s, what was called a luxury tax. Necessities weren't taxed, but if you went out and bought a yacht or a fur coat, they were considered luxuries, and they were taxed. So living day to day, the person who barely makes ends meet should not be paying taxes. He's one of the cogs in the machine that makes this environment for Congress to operate. He's a participant, and if Congress pays it, then he'll have to pay it when he buys the product. And if that product is luxury, he should pay more. But if it's necessity, there shouldn't even be a tax on necessity. Most grocery stores, most states, California had what they call the Twinkie tax. California said that food is a necessity, therefore there's no sales tax on food. There are other objects. Some states allow clothing and different things to be included in non-taxable items. They had what they called the Twinkie tax because Twinkies were so popular that the government was losing a lot of revenue, and they said, that's a luxury, that's not a necessity, and we want to tax Twinkies. You know, the little cakes with the cream inside. It was called the Twinkie tax bill. They tried to move that over into the tax bill. I think they did. I don't know. I wasn't in California at the time. I just read about it. And I haven't bought Twinkies to see if they charge me taxes on it. But necessities should not be taxed. And people that struggle to make ends meet should not be overburdened with taxation. They shouldn't pay any tax except perhaps that of educating their children based on their ownership of property. But commerce should pay it. And if you divide it all, if you get rid of the IRS and the hundreds of billions of dollars that's spent on H&R Block and people like that, there's a lot more money in circulation. Of course, there's a lot of unemployed people, too, the entire Internal Revenue Service, or most of it, and all the H&R Block people and all these other tax groups, and even the ones that write the software for taxes. But think of how much different a world would be. So, you know, when I think about that, I got to wonder about taxes. Is it more social engineering? And let's go back to what FDR felt about bonds, that once you pay, you feel an obligation to support. So if I pay taxes, I kind of bought into the idea of big government. Well, I haven't, and I don't pay taxes. I don't believe in big government. So is taxing a way of creating the same empathy for government that the bonds did during World War II, that we feel obliged to the government because we're already voluntarily giving them money. So we must believe in them, and you can't turn against what you believe in. Social engineering is probably the primary reason for taxes now. They've used it to encourage certain industry and discourage other industry by giving tax deductions for this and not giving deductions for that. One is the green industry. You know, if you back when they had made some innovations in heating systems, if you put them in, you got tax breaks for it. If you go solar power now, you get tax breaks for it. You buy electricity, they end up penalizing you. The federal government gets a little bit of your electric bill. So they have learned to manipulate us by using taxes, and I firmly believe that it is their tool of social engineering, one of their tools of social engineering.
All right. Now, there's two other questions I just got over Skype. Before I get to that, I just want to give a quick notice to the audience. Look, guys, if you send me an instant message over Skype, I'm not going to attribute it to you because I presume that you want your privacy to some degree because we are doing a live broadcast right now. So look, if you want to be attributed, put the question in our chat room at, you know, for OPF Radio, located at outpost-of-freedom.com/radio. And if for some reason you have your feelings regarding privacy with your handle or whatever, choose a different handle. The Chatango system allows you to temporarily choose a different one or whatever. But otherwise, I'm not going to attribute to you if you send me an instant message, all right? So just for the future.
If you get a Skype message and Joe says, this is Joe and I want to ask, or if you write your name before the question, if you don't mind the attribution, then Sleepy, you can read it, as long as they type their name in as well.
Right. Okay. I'll keep that in mind. But yeah, just for the future, guys, if you want to be attributed, put it in the chat room. Even if you want to put under another alias, that's fine. But do keep in mind that these broadcasts that are a labor of love are not just for the people who live right now. This is also for posterity. For various reasons. So if you want to go into the future, even after your mortal demise, please keep in mind that, if you care about attribution, to please abide by that, and we would appreciate it very much. So these are the last Skype IMs I will bring up because it is relevant. The first one is there a realistic difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion?
Heck, I don't know. I would think that avoidance is probably using loopholes, the Schedule G that I mentioned, or tax-free bonds or something like that. You're avoiding taxes by following their rules. Tax evasion is recognizing that you have an obligation but not fulfilling that obligation. I'm not a tax evader. I don't evade taxes. I pay all lawful taxes. And again, 29 years, I think, attest to the fact that I pay all lawful taxes. I think, is trying to use the tools to avoid paying taxes. That's the way I take it.
Yeah, loopholes.
Evasion,
yeah,
is what Al Capone made the mistake of doing.
Yeah,
he owed taxes, and then he didn't pay them.
Yeah, basically violating Molliber Hibbitaw, right. Now, the second one was, can any taxes be safely avoided if you don't bank?
That's mixing apples and oranges. If you don't bank, if you bank, you have given the bank the, in writing, which we did in a banking program, you have given them in writing permission to pay any debts that come to them that they believe are obligations of yours. Now, I think in that program, I also talked about what happened to me back in 1981, that because of some clients not paying their bills, I ran short of money, so I did not pay the withholding tax into the IRS at the bank like I was supposed to, And they came and seized my bank account. Now, the bank manager was a friend of mine. I used to play poker with him, a group of people, and he was one of them. We were good friends. We used to have lunch together. When he gave my money to the Internal Revenue Service, everything, every penny, $9,000 out of my bank account, I said, why did you do that? They didn't have a court order. They got to have a court order to get my money. And he said, Gary, I got two choices. I can either make them come up with something out of the court, or I can give them the money. If I make them come up with something out of the court, they're going to audit my bank, and they're going to try out my staff for months because of the audit. What would you do if you were in my place? So when you bank, what you've done is you've given the third party, the bank, the opportunity to judge whether you have an obligation or not. Now, I'm not sure how this plays into it, but I know that the tag is there. When you open a bank account, you have to give them a Social Security number. In this day age of computers, they just go through all the banks and says, okay, where's the Social Security number? Or here's an account, here's an account, here's an account. He owes us some money. Let's tell the bank he owes us some money, and they'll give us the money. So what you've done is you've put your money on the table and kind of challenged the IRS to take it by putting it in a bank. You have put it on the table and said, if you think you want it, if you want it, I guess you can come and get it because it's right there on the table. So it's not really a part of the same issue. Banking in itself has just given somebody else the ability to pay your bills if they perceive their obligations of yours.
Yes, and just for reference for context for the listeners, if you go back in our archives, I think it was actually the last episode we did, it is entitled I Don't Bank, Can You Do It Too? And just listen to that for more information on not banking. And speaking of source citations, one of the ones I just thought of, since you mentioned Larkin Rose earlier,
that was the April Fool's program. Now we're tax day program. So.
right. And actually, speaking about source citation, before I forget, we have mentioned Larkin Rose in the past with regard to something else. If you folks want to know more about Larkin Rose, at least in the context we were mentioning, I would refer you to the previous episode we did entitled How to Talk to a Cop If You Want to.
Which has nothing to do with taxes.
Right. Now, let's see. It was interesting because we had that question earlier about the Federal Reserve. So I guess the next question really would be, what is the relationship between taxes, inflation, and debt?
Well, that's a very complex question, but let's see if we can simplify it. Inflation is a consequence of debt, which is a consequence of taxes, because they could not, as I read from ratification, they have to have a source to pay off the debt. That source is taxes. Now, when they get into this upside-down situation, which people lose their homes over, they simply print more money. But if I print more money and put it in circulation, I cause inflation. If there's $100 million in circulation and I double that, a nickel candy bar all of a sudden will cost a dime because the buying power balances back out to the amount of money in circulation. So nickel candy bars in 1968, right now inflation is about 20 times that nickel candy bar cost $1.80 or something like, maybe even $2 by now. It's a consequence of money going into the system. The money wouldn't be going into the system if the government was fiscally responsible. If the taxes offset the debt of the obligations, the financial obligations of the country, it would work. When debt is created and government has to pay interest on that debt, then they have to take your taxes, tax money, to pay the debt service before, and it could be interest only, no principal, before they can provide the services that they have an obligation to provide. So as they have this obligation to provide the services, and the debt service has taken all the tax dollars into just paying that, the only recourse for additional money to pay for the necessary services is to put more money in circulation. When they put more money in circulation, that creates inflation, which devalues the dollar because the buying power goes back to where it was before. So they're interrelated, but the relationship is extremely complex. The Creature from Jekyll Island by Dr. Griffin, I think, goes into part of that. But it's an intricate web, and they are all related. And debt is the principal problem. And that debt was created by their ability to reach as deeply into our pocket as they want, because they always had a resource to pay that debt. As that last one I read from Ratification said, the ability for direct taxes gives us the insurance of being able to borrow money because we can pay it back by resorting to direct taxes. So I hope that is a satisfactory, simple answer to a complex question.
All right. Well, speaking of inflation, I guess the $64,000 question is, you know, pardon the pun, is inflation a form of taxation?
Well, yes, and it's part of that relationship we just discussed, because when government has to provide the services after the debt service is paid, they print more money. When they print that money, what they're doing is, it's like splitting stocks. When they split stocks, the stocks have half the value they had before, but you got twice as many stocks, so you've got the same value you had. So when they tax this dollar, they have, and that leads to inflation. Then, how to explain this? Let's see. The inflation then, by taking half my purchasing power, has actually taxed me half of what I own if the amount of money doubles. So, yes, the government becomes the beneficiary by an indirect method of the purchasing power that I lose as a consequence of inflation. Kind of hard to explain in a few minutes, but it is a form of taxation, because the government is a beneficiary because they create the currency and put it in circulation, reducing the value of what you have earned already. Let's look back at Social Security. When I started working, minimum wage was $1.25 an hour. So I had years of earning where, you know, $50 a week was what you made. When I went in the Army, I think I started out at $68 a month. Now, you can't even consider living off of that now. But the purchasing power at the $800 or $1,000 they get in going, I don't know what it is in the Army now, has been taken by the government, so we've got this big counters. And we also move up in tax brackets because of the change in how we count the money, where we end up paying more taxes than we would have before by holding the same breakpoint for increases in taxes. I don't know if I can explain it any clearer than that. It is rather complex, but there is no doubt that inflation, by reducing purchasing power, transfers that purchasing power to government and effectively is a tax. It's just not called one.
Well, I think we were mentioning earlier about tax day and, you know, how people have certain reactions to that. Something I want to bring up. Would it promote the Patriot cause, Gary, for people within the Patriot community and friendly factions to help deliver tax returns? For example, as the Libertarian Party does, or at least used to, each year on April 15th?
Wouldn't that be like escorting somebody to jail? I think the Patriot cause would be best served by people understanding the consequences of taxes, not encouraging participation within it. Now, I'm not saying discourage participation because of the inherent risk in it, but if the Patriot cause said, okay, we'll help you deliver your tax returns, that's the Patriot community saying, we agree you should pay your taxes. And I can't condone that. I really can't. So I would say it would be like leading them to prison and being defying, absolutely defying the intention of the Constitution, which is what the Patriot community should be adhering to, is the Constitution as written and intended.
Well, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, the rationale for why this was done was because, well, you know, a lot of the, you know, mainline public are going to file their taxes anyway, so why not just take advantage of the opportunity, help deliver the tax returns, and at the same time try to appeal to their better nature, I guess, as an opportunity for outreach or some such thing. That was the rationale anyway. I mean, are you suggesting then that kind of rationale is at best counterproductive, if not quite possibly blatantly hypocritical, in terms of principle anyway?
Well, let me hold your hat and meet Mr. Guillotine. I can't reconcile that would serve the Patriot community in any way to support the fiscal irresponsibility of government. It's destructive. It has taxed my great-great-great-great-grandchildren. And to anything that would be supportive of that or encouraging participating in that destructive system. Taxation has put a debt on unborn children. There was pretty good YouTube, or maybe it was a promotional, maybe went on television. Then you see it in the Tea Party movement. People carrying and these are the numbers from, I think, 2 years ago, little kids carrying a sign, I owe $38,000 in taxes, and all I own is a dollhouse.
Yeah, I remember seeing those.
Who would want to encourage, in any way, shape, or form, even implied, the participation in a system like that that is so destructive of our posterity? Our founders were trying to provide something good for posterity, and by us encouraging participation in the tax system, we are damning our posterity. Is that the role that you want to be recognized for when you're dust?
No, of course not. And I don't think anybody listening I'm saying this in good faith. I don't think anybody listening would want to participate in that, even unwittingly.
And that is my answer, yes.
All right. Well, to kind of start winding down for tonight then, how do we start getting back to, for lack of a better term anyway, how do we start getting back to a fiscally conservative monetary policy?
Well, I don't know if we can evolve back, because the problem is so great, unless we take some drastic measures. Now, one drastic measure directly related to this that I've proposed in what's called the Economic Solution, and the link man will have to look that up and put it out there, is a complete revision of the monetary system without any participation with the Federal Reserve bankers. It's rather drastic, but it would reconcile the money problem that we have in this country today in a period of perhaps 5 years, because it can't be done overnight. You'd have to read The Economic Solution, my article, is on my blog. The other one is the Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government, which tears it down to the foundation, the Constitution, and rebuilds the government, which is even more drastic. However, to maintain fiscal responsibility, you have to reduce taxes. The free marketplace has to function on its own. The better it functions at lower tax rates, the more the government gets. But the big problem is the same one that you have in your household. The average credit card debt in Sacramento is $9,000 per credit card. $9,000 per credit card. Damn, that's a lot of money. If I get to the credit card limit, I got two choices. Start paying it down or ask them to increase the limit. Well, the government says increase the limit. Sound policy is reduce spending. But look, what they've talked about as far as reducing spending, it's all punitive. If they reduce spending, they call it sequestering, and you're going to hurt because of it. They're afraid to reduce spending because their friends are getting the money. But absent reduction of spending, there is no solution. And then reduction of taxes so that people are comfortable with their lives and money circulates more freely actually provides a higher rate of taxes, and I think it's been proven historically that when taxes are reduced, the economy gets a little bit healthier until the government decides that they're going to go spend some more. So first is a very substantial and difficult process of getting away from the Federal Reserve system and getting back to a stable-based economy, at least internally within the country. And the second one is to get government spending back to only that which is necessary to maintain the necessary services of government and nothing beyond that.
So
after
just
that, you ain't going to get there.
So just to clarify for the audience, just that there is no confusion or misunderstandings later, if I'm hearing you right, what you're saying is that in terms of broaching the tax issue on a wide-scale, systematic basis, it's, I want to phrase this carefully, it's not enough to do any sort of reform. We're basically talking about the plan at this point.
Well, not necessarily. The you know, if we adopted the what I call the economic solution, we could correct the money system. And it's a more realistic approach than in the Fed, because when you're in the Fed, what do you do? Well, it's kind of in the Fed, and here's what we do when we're in the Fed. That's a drastic action, but you're not going to get Congress to go along with it. That's the problem. So chances are the plan is the only solution. To give you an idea, though, as far as tax protests being effective, years ago, I was talking to my parents. They wanted to pay my tax bill, but if I paid my tax bill, I was going to be stuck jumping back in the system, and I'd be bound the rest of my life as a voluntary player in the game, honestly voluntary, not deceived into paying taxes. And I was talking to them about taxes, and I said, why don't you stop paying taxes? And my mother said, well, we'll stop paying our taxes if everybody else will. And I think that probably 99% of the people in this country have the same philosophy. If everybody else stops paying taxes, they'll be glad to stop paying taxes. Problem is, or the impossible problem is, how do you get 99% of the people, or even 90%, or even 50%, to one day just stop paying taxes? If it can grow as a movement and catch on, that's one thing. But to think that you can get these people to stop paying taxes, and then I will too, is you've got to get everybody to move at once. But who moves first? Well, I've moved first, but you can't get it. They think I'm an anomaly. Oh, you're not paying taxes. I'd love to not pay taxes, but I'm afraid to. So you can't get there through a process of tax protesting. I don't believe it could ever be effective. I used to think that it could, that it would grow. But it doesn't, because the government owns the mainstream media, and they will publish the penalty that people suffer for not paying taxes.
Yeah, they make an example out of people, basically.
Right.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you, Gary, for joining us tonight and really kind of explaining the ins and outs of taxes as they are practiced here in the United States. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good night.
All right, everyone. That is going to conclude this episode of OPF Radio. please consider joining us 2 weeks from today for our next episode on April 29th, where we ask the question, verbicide, socially engineered law, be free, stay free, and laissez-faire.
I had a dream the other night that, well, I didn't understand. A figure walked in through the mist with a flintlock in his hand. His clothes were torn and dirty as he stood there by my bed. He took off his three-cornered hat, and speaking low to me, he said, "We fought a revolution to secure our liberty. We wrote the Constitution as a shield from tyranny. For future generations, this legacy we gave. In this, the land of the free and home of the brave. The freedoms we secured for you, we hoped you'd always keep. But tyrants labored endlessly while your parents were asleep. Your freedom's gone, your courage lost, you're no more than a slave. In this, the land of the free and home of the brave. You buy permits to travel and permits to own a gun, permits to start a business or to build a place for one. On land that you believe you own, you pay a yearly rent, although you have no voice in saying how the money's spent. Your children must attend a school that doesn't educate, and your Christian values can't be taught according to the state. You read about the current news in a regulated press, and you pay a tax you do not owe to please the IRS. Your money is no longer made of silver nor of gold. You trade your wealth for paper so your life can be controlled. You pay for crimes that make our nation turn from God in shame. You've taken Satan's number. You've traded in your name. You've given government control to those who do you harm so they could burn down churches and seize the family farm and keep our country deep in debt. Put men of God in jail. Harass your fellow countrymen while corrupted courts prevail. Your public servants don't uphold the solemn oaths they've sworn. And your daughters visit doctors so their children won't be born. Your leaders send artillery and guns to foreign shores and send your sons to slaughter fighting other people's wars. Can you regain the freedoms for which we fought and died? Or don't you have the courage or the faith to stand with pride? And are there no more values for which you'll fight to save? Or do you wish your children to live in fear and be a slave? Oh, sons of the Republic, arise, take a stand. Defend the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. Preserve our great republic and each God-given right. And pray to God to keep the torch of freedom burning bright. As I awoke, he'd vanished in the mist from whence he came. His words were true. We are not free, but we have ourselves to blame. For even now as tyrants trample each God-given right, we only watch and tremble, too afraid to stand and fight. If he stood by your bedside in a dream while you were asleep and wondered what remains of the freedoms he'd fought to keep, what would be your answer if he called out from the grave, "Is this still the land of the free and home of the brave?" God bless you, and God bless this room.